Are you satisfied now? ANA governance asked as Paula emerged out into the mellow Parisian daylight.
Not entirely, no.
It is not possible to break into the directorate vault.
I know, but there are a few other possibilities. Resurrecting her is something I've given a lot of thought to over the centuries. There are still plenty of fanatics out there.
The Knight's Guardians don't actually want her alive and walking round. It is politically convenient to have a leader who will return in the far future. That gives them plenty of leeway.
Now, where have I heard that before?
That is a strange weakness of yours, Paula.
We're all entitled to one.
So do you still believe it was her on Sholapur?
I think it's a strong possibility that I encountered a full clone version.
Her DNA is probably easy to obtain, but where would they get a copy of her memory? We know she never had a secure store. She was too worried your directorate would gain access to it.
Her weakness, Paula said flatly. However, there is one copy that I know of. I'll check it out.
I'm not being critical, but there are other matters that require attention, quite urgent attention. If the respite Justine has bought us is to have any value, I must know what the accelerators are planning.
Are you trying to guilt me into chasing round after Marius and his cronies?
I have to use guilt.
If the cat has been brought back in some form by the accelerators, they clearly want her for some very dirty, deniable work. But, as I suspect they're discovering, she's not easy to control. Her personal agenda will always come first. I can use that to catch her. Once she's in custody, she can be fully interrogated.
An interesting application of logic.
But logical nonetheless.
Assuming you're correct about Sholapur.
I believe a great deal of my usefulness to you comes from my instinct, a facet of personality you have yet to acquire.
Correct.
Thank you. However, you are right about following other leads.
I reviewed Troblum's file on my way here.
That presentation he made to Casimir was very interesting.
Yes. I considered it to be well argued and highly plausible.
That's not what I mean. It implies he has a very strong knowledge of the Dark Fortress itself.
The Navy maintains an effective force around the Dyson pair. It would not be possible for him to gain access to either of them.
It would if he was part of the Navy's science team. There aren't many people, especially hires, who have his physical profile. Please review all the Navy personnel to have served at the Dyson pair since the Starflyer War.
There wasn't even a moment of hesitation. That was an excellent deduction. I have the file.
Paula examined it. The identity was recorded as one Kent Vernon, a physicist from Salto. Exo-image showed her a face similar to Troblum's, but with ebony skin.
He darkened his pigmentation considerably.
Though that face is definitely recognizable.
Oh, of course. That name. He is descended from Mark Vernon.
She smiled at the memory of Mark, a man really out of his depth, but a thoroughly decent human being. And Mark was married to Liz, who was Afro-American. Very neat, she complimented, if lacking in imagination. I'm surprised his accelerator controller allowed that.
He served a 6-month tour of duty on the Navy Exploration Division science ship Poix 56 years ago, ANA reported. That particular research mission was concentrating on the inner two lattice spheres. They made some progress mapping the integral quantum function. Though the Navy project is still ongoing, we still don't quite understand the mechanism behind the Dark Fortress.
Even you.
Even me.
And according to his file, Kent Vernon subsequently downloaded into you, Paula said as she scanned the exo image. That ties up any loose ends as far as an inconvenient outside investigation is concerned. So let's see what real facts we can find.
Her U-Shadow called up the records from Troblum's apartment and Daroka's utilities. Those for the period 56 years ago were already deep cached, but they were soon accessed with her authority rating.
Look at that power consumption rate, she said.
Nominal, for 10 years, implying Troblum wasn't there. Whatever he was doing took him off Arevalo for a decade.
What kind of device takes a decade to build? His planet-shifting FTL drive has taken longer.
Yes, but that was his personal obsession, and he was doing it with a minimal MEA budget. What would take the accelerators 10 years with all their resources, and how is it connected to Dark Fortress technology?
That was what Troblum wanted to tell you.
Why didn't he just come straight out with it? She said in annoyance.
He is a genuine paranoid, understandably, given the clandestine projects he's been associated with and under the supervision of Marius. A paranoia which was fully vindicated by events on Sholapur. He has probably left the Commonwealth altogether now. His starship seems quite capable of such a flight, even without Ultra Drive.
I'd certainly like to leave so I can believe that, Paula admitted. Unfortunately, wishful thinking is a luxury right now. List everyone who served with Troblum, and mind their history, please. Start with his captain.
The captain of the POEX was Donald Chatfield, a higher, currently resident on Ganthia.
All right. I concede this is more pertinent than the lead I have on the cat. I'll go and interview Chatfield.
As you wish.
And you really can't guess what the accelerators might have built?
No. According to Gore, they wish to duplicate me and fuse this replica with the void to initiate post-physical evolution. The systems to initialize another, such as myself, would be complex, but they wouldn't require any input from the Dark Fortress technology.
Will that fusion work?
Who knows?
Very well. I'll call in as soon as I have something.
Paula activated her field interface function, designating her exit coordinate. Earth's T-sphere immediately translated her back up to Skypier. As she crossed the reception center to the station terminus, her U-shadow told her Casimir was calling.
Bad news, he said.
Paula's heart performed a little flutter. There weren't many people left in the galaxy she cared about, but Justine was one of them.
Justine?
No, I have no further information on Mother, which, as far as I'm concerned, is good news. But I am in contact with the Lindau.
I don't know the ship.
It's the Navy scout I dispatched to Hanko to monitor the whole Aeron situation for you.
And?
They don't have the best sensors in the fleet, but there's something wrong with the planet.
Wrong in what way?
It's gravity. We believe someone has fired a Hawking M-sync into it.
Oh, Christ, no. Why would they do that? It's a dead planet anyway.
The Restoration Project base at Jajani has stopped broadcasting. Lindau is still picking up some of the project's surface beacons, so it looks as if the base itself was targeted.
But an M-Sync? That's a monstrous overkill. We know those ships were Ultra Drive. They'll be equipped with weapons powerful enough to take out an undefended civilian base.
I don't know the reason, I'm just reporting the results. Naturally, there's no sign of either Ultra Drive ship.
Naturally.
However,
yes?
The Lindau has also picked up a very powerful distress signal from the surface. It's a standard bionic emission. Nobody listed as a member of the restoration team was higher.
So it's either Aeron or Inigo himself?
Yes, which leaves me with a rather painful decision. With an M-Sync eating away its core, that planet isn't going to last much longer. The Lindau estimates a few hours more at best before the mantle starts to readjust prior to implosion, at which point nothing is going to survive. So, do they land at Jajani and see if there are any survivors?
No, she said immediately. They have to recover whoever is sending that signal with bionics.
One person.
If the M-Sync hit at Jajani, there will be nothing to recover from there, not even bodies, and certainly not any secure memory stores. Everyone working in restoration projects knows there are risks. They all have backup memories and DNA samples on their home world. They will be relifed. If there is the slightest chance that survivor is Inigo, or can tell us where Inigo is, then you have to rescue them.
I was thinking along those lines myself, but it's always satisfying to receive your endorsement. I'll speak with the captain and keep you updated.
Casimir.
Yes.
Warn them to take extreme precautions. If it is Aeron down on the surface, there's no telling what he'll do.
I know. I'll emphasize the need for caution.
Paula drew a deep breath and gazed down through the transparent hull section of Sky Pier's reception center. Bordeaux was spread out below the station, lush and beautiful in the lazy sunlight. She'd visited a few times when the vineyards were still producing their renowned wine, and the remaining citizens stubbornly resisted the advances which the Commonwealth provided. Something about the area and its culture had made her feel comfortable and welcome, satisfying that deep human yearning for a simple life, a fundamental which had never been sequenced out of her psyche by her creators. She wondered what its long-departed people would make of today's life, with all its associated bizarre problems. Somehow she suspected they'd be less than impressed. Looking down on the region again, a small part of her wanted to just teleport down there and settle in one of the remaining homes, cut off communication, deactivate her bionics, leaving her far away from Casimir and Aaron and Marius and the cat and all the rest of it. Supposedly, there were several primitive groups on Earth, living as their ancestors had 2,000 years ago. ANA always denied it, but rumors persisted. Not this time, though, she decided. So she walked into the terminus with its glowing Cherenkov light from the wormhole which led back to Orleans. From there, another wormhole connected directly to Arevalo. By the time she got back to Daroka spaceport, the Alexis Denken would have been resupplied and the medical chamber replaced. The starship would be ready to fly her onwards. Again. It had been over a year since Araminta had visited the house. At the time, she'd looked on the compact dry coral building as a development project, seeing costs and returns in everything, ignoring the family which had welcomed her in and given her a lovely Sunday dinner. Now, when the door opened and Tandra's face peered out, Araminta couldn't help herself. She burst into tears. Life hadn't been so bad back when she was waiting tables in Nick's. It really hadn't. She'd been part of a larger collective family. Tandra and the other waitresses had included her in their gossip and lives. They'd hung out together between shifts, and some evenings they'd gone out in a big group, having a good time even though she'd been flat broke. The very same people she'd ignored and left behind once Larrell's money had come through. Tandra's immediate unqualified concern and graciousness at the stray appearing unannounced on her doorstep simply made Araminta feel even more wretched. "There, there," Tandra crooned and gave her a motherly hug. "It's all right." Martin, her husband, was also attentive, clearing the kids' toys from the settee in the living room. Mixal and Freddy, their 5-year-old twins, were given fruit smoothies to hush them up while Araminta blew into tissues and tried to get her sobbing under control. "I'm sorry," she wailed. "I shouldn't have come. I've nowhere else to go." And at the back of her mind was the worry that just by being here, she was putting Tandra's family in danger. "You're more than welcome, and you know that," her old friend told her. "Did you have a fight? Have you left him?" She was giving Araminta's roughed-up clothes a highly suspicious examination. "No, nothing like that. There's a whole bunch of people in the park outside my apartment. They're very angry. The invader soldiers are there as well. I was frightened." "Those bastards," Martin grunted. Tandra shot him a warning look, her gaze darting pointedly to the twins who were watching intently over the back of a chair they were sharing. "Yes, they are unpleasant people who have behaved wrongly," she said with parental formality. "However, the law will prevail and they will be expelled from our world." Martin rolled his eyes. "Yes, they will." "And until they do, you can sleep on the couch," Tandra assured her. "Just for one night," Araminta promised. "That's all. I need to get myself back together." "No boyfriend?" Martin asked. "Not right now," Araminta lied. He didn't say anything, but his tight little smile triggered a fresh wave of Araminta's guilt. She didn't dare delve into the Gaia field to learn his emotional state. "We're staying here at home for the rest of the afternoon," Tandra said. "The twins are having the day off school as a treat, aren't you?"
"Yes,"
they yelled gleefully. Martin was looking out of the window. "How did you get here?"
"Walked."
"From where?"
"Bodant."
"That's miles." "They won't allow capsules to fly, and my trike pod is being fixed. Tandra and Martin exchanged a look.
You sit there and rest, Tandra said. I'll give those clothes a wash. Martin, some tea.
Coming right up.
Thank you,
Araminta said meekly. Tandra waited until he'd vanished into the galley kitchen.
Anything else you need to tell me?
Araminta shook her head.
I really will go in the morning. I've already got an idea what to do. There's someone I need to talk to. I'll call him tomorrow.
When I've worked out how to.
Okay. I'd better go get a robe for you. Martin will have a heart attack if he sees you walking round the place in your underwear.
She patted her own legs. He's only used to women a size or 10 bigger than a youngster like you. Araminta grinned.
I missed you. Sure you did. Out there enjoying yourself every night. I bet you thought of me the whole time.
She gave the twins a critical look.
I swore I'd never have any kids again this life around. This one would be for me. But what the hell? A girl doesn't stand a chance with a love god like Marty.
Araminta started laughing, then stopped, casting a guilty look at the kitchen archway.
That's better, Tandra said. You have the world's greatest smile, honey. That's why the rest of us always insisted on pooling the tips on your shifts.
She ruffled both of the children as she went past. They gave her an adoring look.
I just love the sleepless nights, the worry, losing my figure, no money, and lack of sex. It's character building.
I'm going to find out myself one day.
Sure you will. And your introduction starts today.
Her voice rose a couple of levels.
Guess what? Auntie Araminta is on dinner duty tonight. Then she's going to give you both a bath and wash your hair.
Yes!
The twins yelled jubilantly.
Still want to stay?
Oh, yes, Araminta said.
This house, Tandra, the twins, it felt like an oasis of decency amid the madness raging outside. After the last 2 days, she badly needed to remind herself what normal was. Then I might be able to work out how to get back there myself.
700 years ago, Wilson Keim had officially handed over control of the Commonwealth Navy to Casimir. It was the fifth time Wilson had held the role of Supreme Commander. On that occasion, it was essentially a ceremonial appointment, lasting a single year before he downloaded into ANA, his final farewell to the physical. After the formal handover for the benefit of the President, senior senators and Unisphere reporters, the two of them had gone up to the Admiral's office on the top floor of the 30-story Pentagon II tower. Wilson had given Casimir 2 pieces of advice as they stood looking across the agreeable parkland of the Babuyan Atoll Dome. "Don't ever give in to political pressure," Wilson had said. "I've been president myself, so I know the convenience of a military who'll snap to and say yes to every dark instruction you issue. Resist them. Stick to the fundamentals. We have 2 roles, as ordained by the Senate in more honorable times, protecting the human race in all its forms against alien aggressors, and peaceful scientific exploration of the galaxy. That's all. Don't let the executive wear that down. The general population must have faith in us." "I can hold the line," Casimir assured him. "And second, feel free to change this goddamn office. I always hated it. Never got round to redecorating, so now every crappy white molecule qualifies as tradition because this is the way it was when we gained our victory over Morning Light Mountain. Every other admiral from Raphael onwards just rolled over and accepted that. I want you to give the conservation fascists a good kicking and bring in your own furniture." Casimir smiled at the man's strange passion. They shook hands. "I will," he promised. To date, he'd proudly held that line through some extraordinary, difficult political events. The second promise hadn't been broken, exactly. Like Wilson, he just hadn't got round to changing things yet. Today, he looked out of the office to see a circular habitat that also hadn't changed that much in the last 7 centuries. Pentagon II was still the same, which was more than could be said of the original back on Earth that ANA had decided wasn't significant enough to maintain. Several buildings had been reshaped, High Angel adapting their growing stone material in accordance to each new set of human requirements. It was the living parkland itself which had seen the most alteration,
The average level of the tree canopy had risen by over 50 meters since the day Casimir had assumed command. Under the protective dome of the Rael Ark ship, the organic environment was perfect. Every species of tree prospered in a way they could never do on a planet with variable seasons and winds and fires and earthquakes and diseases and parasites and bark-eating creatures. Here there was no real reason for them to die, so they just kept on growing, nurtured by their flawless climate. There were some monster arboreals out there. 20 or so had even reached the same height as Pentagon II, their osmosis now assisted by High Angel, which had reduced the gravity field around them, allowing nutrients to flow unhindered all the way to the topmost branches. It was a forest which could never exist on a planet, and all the more alluring because of it. When he glanced up, Casimir saw Ike Kalanisi was a slim, tawny crescent overhead. The new storm seemed to bulge out of the great northern cloud band. He'd been watching the moon-sized storm growing for 2 centuries now, absorbing all the smaller storms it clashed with to become the largest of all the gas giant cyclonic swirls. Human starships flitted around the orbital cluster of stations and micro-G factories like a metallic shoal, mostly Navy craft, with a few commercial freighters and passenger ships. High Angel was still the largest Navy port in the Greater Commonwealth. Its residents took a lot of pride in that, supplying a disproportionate amount of officers. Casimir gathered his thoughts and returned to his big white desk. The office's ancient tragwood furniture really was aesthetically awful, made worse by the clinical glowing walls and ceiling. But he did concede it was comfortable as he sank back into the cushioning. "Convene the Exo-Protectorate Council," he told his U-Shadow. The office dissolved from his natural vision, leaving him in the perceptual conference room with its white and orange furniture. Not much of an improvement on his own, he reflected sadly, looking out over the tempestuous furor of the Malavian plains. Gor and Alanthi appeared first, sitting next to each other. The Accelerator faction representative had changed her appearance since the last meeting, allowing her dark hair to hang down to her waist in a single tail wrapped with red leather bands. She wore a stylish black dress of horizontal pleats. She nodded politely to Gor, who was in his golden incarnation, dressed in a perfectly tailored tuxedo. "Any news of Justine?" Alanthi asked. Gore's gaze flicked to the chair Justine had occupied last time the council convened. "Nothing. I guess we'll have to wait to see if the second dreamer deigns to reveal anything to us." Crispin Goldreich arrived. The ancient senator gave Justine's chair a look. "Gor, Casimir," he said formally, "my sympathies to both of you."
"Yeah, thanks," Gor said. "I prefer to consider her successfully positioned to assist us further," Casimir said. "She has achieved something remarkable, after all."
"Yes," Crispin said sheepishly. Kriwan materialized in his chair to the left of Casimir. The custodian faction member gave the admiral a formal bow. He hadn't completed the motion when the Darwinist faction representative, John Felwell, arrived in a seat on the opposite side of the table. The two of them always seemed to appear at the same time. Casimir wondered idly if there was some kind of alliance involved, though how such diverse factions could find any common ground was a mystery.
"Aren't you going to activate Justine's ANA personality?" John Felwell asked in some surprise.
"Why?" Gor asked. "Her actual is still alive. Duplication is still our biggest anathema, isn't it? Or have you converted to that pervert multiple philosophy?"
Felwell threw up his hands. "Fine, if that's how you want to play it."
"If you're ready," Casimir said. "I have the secure link to the Yenisei available."
"All right," Gor said. "Let's take a look and see what the Akasans have come up with."
Captain Lucian was proud of his small crew. For 9 days, the Yenisei had flown in pursuit of the greatest fleet of warships the Akasans had ever assembled. If intelligent summaries about the Star Slayer-class ships was correct, then not even Morning Light Mountain had enjoyed this level of firepower to deploy against the Commonwealth. Unsurprisingly, then, tension on board had been building as they closed on the fleet. Yet he considered they'd coped remarkably well. This mission wasn't anything they'd expected or trained for. However, as one, they had risen to the challenge. Toy, the systems officer, actually relished the chance to confront the Okusens.
"They've learned nothing in 500 years, she said. "They genuinely believe we're just a bunch of decadent animals who got lucky on the technology front. We are the classical immovable object in their way, and all they do is crack what passes for a head against us. They don't try to learn or adapt."
"This fleet is proof they have tried to think round the problem,"
Kylie, the first tactical officer, argued. "They saw what they needed to overcome us, and they set out to obtain it. That's adaptive."
"They set out to steal it," Toy said.
"Negotiating an allegiance is hardly stealing."
"I don't believe they could do that. They found the leftovers of a post-physical and bootstrapped themselves up a whole weapons level."
"Even that's pretty adaptive."
The argument had been just about continuous. The four of them had completely different positions. Not that it interfered with their tasks. Although Lucien was slightly concerned about Giovan, the second tactical officer, whose solution to the whole Okusen problem was unpleasantly crude, he would be allying himself directly to the accelerators at Download, Lucien decided, if not the isolationists or possibly the more radical Darwinists. For a moment, he did worry about confronting the fleet with Giovan's hand on the trigger of their formidable arsenal, but none of them ever allowed their personal views to affect their professionalism. He was confident they'd deliver the result Admiral Casimir had tasked them with. For 18 hours, they'd flown beside the Okusen fleet in stealth mode and monitored the alien warships. To Lucien's huge relief, they were all Okusen.
"Unless they've got stealth," Kylie pointed out after the first hour.
"You can't stealth a continuous wormhole drive," Giovan countered. "In any case, you can only minimalize the hyperdrive emission and damp down its distortion effect. You're never truly stealthed to a top-level sensor array. Detection and concealment technology are a constant race for superiority."
"But we're not registering anything?" Lucien asked.
"No, Captain," Giovan said. "We could use more active scanning, of course, but that would give us away."
"Let's not make this any more difficult. Continue monitoring their communications. We need to identify the command ship."
The Okusen fleet hierarchy was, of course, a replica of their imperial structure, with the Emperor Nest having ultimate authority. Individual captains had very little leeway. Consequently, the communication traffic reflected that, with one ship issuing orders to everyone else. There was no cross-ship chatter. Once they'd identified the command ship, beyond any doubt, Lucien called Admiral Casimir and received authorization for the interception.
"Knock them out of FTL," Casimir said, "and deliver our warning. They are to turn around, or every ship will be disabled."
"I'm not quite sure we can achieve that," Lucien said. "The Yenisei packs a hell of a punch, but there's over 2,500 ships out there, including 900 Star Slayers. If even 20 of them combine, they can get through our shields."
"Lucien, I could never countenance disabling the fleet in deep space, not when they're already so far past the Empire's boundary. They simply don't have the ships nor resources to mount a viable rescue operation. The crews would perish. That is not something I wish to have on my conscience, nor that of any of my officers. No, today is simply a reminder of our technological superiority. I suspect it will have to be repeated several times until they realize they cannot physically achieve their goal."
"Understood, sir," Lucien said with some relief.
The four of them settled on their couches in the main cabin and merged with the smart core. It gave them a perceptual viewpoint from the front of the fuselage. Yenisei curved away beneath them. The main hull was a fat cylinder, 80 meters long, with a conical nose section. Midships sprouted 3 radial fins supporting bulbous weapons nacelles, each of which curved down to a sharp point. A uniform luminous blue representation of hyperspace flowed around them, as though they were some yacht sailing an ocean. Lucien was fed senses that revealed flaws in the blueness, a constellation of dark splinters surrounded by a green haze of exotic energy, the Okusen warships. He directed the Yenisei until it was holding station a kilometer away from the command ship.
"Are we ready?"
he asked quietly.
"Yes, sir,"
Kylie replied.
"Excellent. Giovan, You have fire authority as of now. Keep scanning for any anomalous activity, just in case. Toy, I want total systems availability, high status. He scanned the Ockerson ship. It was 250 meters long, a fat ovoid shape, with thin edges like curving wings. The hull was rough, strewn with irregular lumps, as if it had somehow become encrusted with barnacles during its flight. Although the scan couldn't perceive its color, he knew it would be a dull metallic shade, dappled by furry green patches. All Ockerson starships were like that after they developed their semi-organic extrusion technology. "Pull it out," he told Kylie. The NSA's energy manipulators produced wildly fluctuating waveforms that intersected the exotic energy cascading fluidly around the star's layer. Instabilities immediately started to skitter along its wormhole. Kylie analyzed the modifier effects which the warship's drive exerted in an attempt to regain control, and simply overwhelmed them with the raw power available to the NSA's systems. The rest of the fleet shot away from them as the wormhole's pseudo-fabric broke down. Within a second, they had vanished into the blueness. Space-time reasserted itself, swamping the blueness with infinite black. Stars shone with unwavering intensity. 800 meters away, the massive Ockerson warship started a laborious tumble. Its protective force field flickered dangerously as uncontained energy pulses swept out from the ruined drive. "Attention, Ockerson ship," Lucian broadcast. "This is the Greater Commonwealth Navy ship, Yenisei. You are hereby ordered to turn your fleet around and return to..." "Oh, shit," Giovanni gulped. A smooth spherical starship appeared from nowhere a kilometer ahead of the Star Slayer. Its force fields were impenetrable. The NSA couldn't even get an accurate quantum signature scan to determine what kind of drive it used.
"Admiral," Lucien called urgently, "we can't..."
The unknown ship fired.
"What the fuck was that?" Gore yelled as the secure link abruptly vanished.
Casimir took a second to review the TD link data. He was so surprised. His tactical staff had produced a number of scenarios, mostly incorporating the Ockersons utilizing weapons technology they'd procured from a more advanced species. This hadn't been a remote consideration.
"I don't recognize that design at all," Ilanthi said. "Do we have any spherical ship on the Navy's intelligence registry?"
"There are some species that utilize a sphere," Casimir said slowly, as his U-Shadow supplied their mostly highly classified data. "But we don't list anything that can disable the River-class starships quite that quickly."
"Disable?" Gore snapped. "What is that? The new politically correct term for blowing it to shit?"
"All we know so far is that the NSA's TD link has failed," Casimir began.
"Come on!"
"I'm afraid I agree with Gore," Ilanthi said. "That was not a warning shot. Yenisei is a warship, one of the best we've got, and designed to operate at long distances. The last thing that fails is the communication. After all, we kept in touch with Justine until the void swallowed her."
"My staff will run a full analysis," Casimir said. "It should help define the nature of the attack."
"The weapon, you mean?" Crispin said.
"I'm with Gore on this, Admiral. You can't start hiding behind language. All of us here today are long past that."
"You are correct," Casimir said, knowing that they were right. The NSA was lost with all hands.
It was hard. He hadn't lost a starship in combat in 600 years, not since the last Ockerson expansion wave. The crew would be re-lifed, of course. But still he had to endure the fact that he'd sent them out there into a hostile environment while they were woefully under-equipped. It was a classic command failure, deploying your people on the basis of bad information under political pressure. The wonder of hindsight.
"In the light of this catastrophe, I propose we send our deterrent fleet to intercept the Ockerson Empire ships," Ilanthi said. "I don't believe we have any choice. Following the loss of the Yenisei, we are seeing a very real and credible threat to the entire Commonwealth. Who knows what that unknown ship is capable of?"
"They are still a long way off," Casimir said. "We can use that interval to discover what their full potential is."
"You're playing God with our future," Crewan said. "I, for one, won't tolerate that."
Casimir gave him a withering look.
I hardly think one unknown warship constitutes an end to our civilization.
You don't know it's just one, Ilanthi said. You don't know if that was their best weapon, or their equivalent of a bow and arrow. Casimir, what is wrong with you? You are charged with defending our entire species. Will you please act as if you care?
I care very much indeed. I continue to maintain we need intelligence on the ally which the Akasans have found themselves. I would like to propose that we send at least one more scout mission to determine what we can of the threat level. We do have time, and I am reluctant to formulate a final response without greater intelligence.
Ilanthi glanced round the table. I will support that on the condition that you at least mobilize the deterrent fleet. If the next interception is destroyed, then the deterrent fleet must be deployed against the Akasans.
I second that, Gore said. The other three gave their assent. I will dispatch 4 capital-class ships, Casimir said. They should be there within 5 days.
I'm not familiar with capital-class ships, John Felwell said. Are they part of the deterrent fleet?
No, they are a grade below that, but I am confident they will be able to hold their own, at least until we know more about the Akasans' allies.
Gore and Casimir remained in the perceptual reality after the others left. Outside the window, the ice meteorites fell in silent splendor, triggering vast electron webs across the dark sky.
You know, in all my time, and for all my clout with ANA, I've never managed to get a single hint out of it concerning the deterrent fleet, Gore said. I would hope not, Casimir told him. It is our ultimate defense. Its nature should not be available for scrutiny and discussion, however well-intentioned. It is enough that we have it.
Now there's the thing, see. Down at my most basic level, I'm an old-fashioned boy, rooted in the physical and distrusting of politicians. I'd hate to think our entire survival prospects are based on a cosmic-sized poker bluff. His golden face looked straight at Casimir.
Do we actually have a deterrence fleet, son? Is it real? It is real, Grandfather. And if the Akasan allies prove stronger than our capital class, I will personally lead it into battle against the Empire's fleet.
All right, then. Forgive an old man his quirks.
Of course.
So what do we do about your mother?
Wait until she contacts us.
You think she will?
I think she's probably mayoress of Macathran by now.
Yeah, Gore grunted, you're probably right. But how will we ever know?
Ask the second dreamer.
Aaron was making good time. He'd already retraced the entire route back to the Olhava camp. Now it was just a simple jog across 900 kilometers of a dead planet's broken, frozen, radioactive ground, and he'd be back at Jajani, which the impact would have reduced to a fractured nightmare of geology, where the few survivors from the outlying camps would be mounting futile rescue attempts. Still, it was his only chance. Not that cheating death meant anything to him. This way was the only possible way to salvage his mission. He was still furious at himself for being so gullible. Inigo must have been playing him from the moment he walked into the excavation chamber, leaking weak thoughts and meek emotions into the Gaia field, lulling him to a level of trust. Stupid. I would never have let it happen if I was thinking straight. But too late for self-recrimination now. If he did get out of this, he'd have to maintain a keen watch on his own motivations and responses, make sure they hadn't degraded further under the assault of the unknowns in his subconscious. The land he was jogging through was an ancient, undulating volcanic plain, scoured of vegetation and crisped over by a thick skin of ice. Residue of the deluge that had swept down from the highlands to the south during the last burst of weather before the temperature plummeted. Odd splinters of rock stuck up through the dull grey crust, torn out of the bedrock by the final inundation of water. Ice particles swirled constantly, as patchy as any summer morning fog. Dense clouds zephyred round in the wind shadow of the outcrops, drumming hard on his suit as he moved through them. His macrocellular clusters were still picking up the beacon line back to Jajani. There was no communication traffic, other than his own distress call. The beacon simply stood there, tiny glows of virtual light across the forlorn world.
The next one was 8 kilometers ahead. Aaron's U-Shadow reported someone sweeping a communication beam across him. He shook his head in disbelief, momentarily suspicious this was another attempt by his subconscious to subvert him. Exovision displays started to show solid data. The broadcast point was directly overhead, and using the same emergency band as his own distress call.
"This is the Navy scout ship Lindau. Are you receiving us?"
Aaron stopped dead and lifted his head to the dreadful tumble of gray clouds.
"Hello?"
The signal beam immediately strengthened and focused.
"Ozzy be damned! Who the hell are you?"
"Cereal," he said, picking a name at random from the restoration staff they'd interviewed back at Jujani.
"Well, Cereal, this is the luckiest day of your lives. Stay put. We're coming down to pick you up. Have you found anyone else?"
"No, sorry. You're the first." Aaron stood and waited as the scout ship fought its way through the clouds in a burst of violent lightning. Ingrav units strained against the wind, lowering it meter by meter. The ship was a broad cylinder, 38 meters long. Its comprehensive sensor clusters retracted into stumpy fins around its midsection. 2 thermal dissipator rings around the rear fuselage glowed a bright ruby red, indicating how much power it was drawing on to hold steady against the fierce atmosphere. Snow hammered against its force field, kicking out a blue sparkle. Malmetal landing struts swelled out fore and aft, and it came to rest 10 meters in front of him.
"You will never believe how good you look to me," Aaron told his rescuers. "We got us a pretty good idea."
The airlock expanded open and a short ramp slid out.
"Sorry about this, but we've been told we have to take precautions. Nobody knows who attacked the restoration project base. We have to hold you in isolation while we scan you and confirm your identity."
"Man, you can shack up with every daughter I ever fathered for all I care. I'll even give you their Unisphere codes. Pretty things they are, too."
Aaron brought every weapon insert he had to full power, adjusted his bionic energy currents for extreme combat, and walked up the ramp.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.